supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
As soon as he won, we all knew the next day people were gonna act up. And as soon as we went to school, it really was a problem. And they're like, oh yeah, Trump won, Trump won.
What happened on that video, it had two students chanting Trump, and then somebody said something derogatory in the background. And it wasn't those students who were carrying the sign.
The call of white power, while students hold a Trump Penn sign in the halls of a school in York, Pennsylvania.
White power!
We put our crisis plan into place. We brought in additional school counselors and then briefing our teachers, communicating out with parents how we don't condone what happened and that is not our school.
This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Sturobin. As we just heard, York, Pennsylvania is one of those places around the country where racial tension flared up around the 2016 presidential election.
I don't agree with multiculturalism, but I am willing, and many white people are willing, to get along with black people. But don't tell me that what you have to deal with white power, because I am white power. So tell me how you're going to deal with me.
Yeah. Local hip-hop artist Naku produced a song called Brothers as a way to get people to talk about racial tension.
It does bother me. I know it bothers a lot of people, and people need to come out and talk about it more instead of just doing nothing about it.
Can we just be brothers? This is a new generation. While we still separate us, can we just be brothers?
We'll hear more from Naku later on and how his experience speaks to a long history of racial tension in the York area, which is in central Pennsylvania and borders the Mason-Dixon line.
The total attitude, it wasn't just black-white. It's we, they. It's I don't like people who are different than I am.
So on the show, part one of a two-part series reported by Emily Previty, we're going to hear what's going on today at the school where the white power incident took place, what the area went through during the tumultuous 1960s, and how the hip-hop artist Naku and a local mayor are trying to spark conversations about race relations. Our first story takes us to the York County School of Technology, which is where the video was shot of students carrying a Trump Pence sign the day after the 2016 election. As for what happened to those students, we found out they were suspended, but privacy laws prevent the school from identifying them. And the young man who said white power in the video no longer goes to York Tech. The incident is still on the minds of students, teachers, and administrators at the school. Our reporter, Emily Previty, spent some time there to get their perspective and find out how they're trying to move forward. And just a warning, there will be some moments of strong language.
A few months had passed before I sat down with the students at York Tech. Four girls who were part of a college guidance program talked to me about this incident that went viral and the extent to which it really represents the culture at their school. Delisha Marshall is a senior at York Tech, and she's heading off to college in the fall out of state. Before Delisha came to Tech, she'd heard about racial tension there.
It always had like a reputation for being racist. Us coming from the middle schools that we came from and stuff like that, like there was Caucasian people and we just never thought we would experience that. It's like you're thinking, okay, yeah, Tech used to be racist, okay, but there's a lot of African American and Hispanics that go to Tech now. So you're like, okay, maybe it's not gonna be like that anymore. But then you do get there and you do experience that a little bit and you're like, you don't know how to deal with it because you never dealt with it before. And a lot of people don't even realize that they are acting like that towards you. Like some people are actually blinded by it. They don't even understand what's going on.
For freshman Escarlani Conche Molina, she's been struck by the way some white students behave toward her in school. It suggests to her they have deeply ingrained racial biases.
In school, they think like they're better than everyone else, and like you can feel it because they just like want to separate you from everything that they do. They always think like they're better than you, like they make you feel down in class. Like, I don't know how to explain it. The looks they give you, it's like they hate you or disrespect.
These girls agree that this tension that's so hard to describe was building last year, giving way to more concrete incidents because of the presidential election.
This random person in class came up to me when I was trying to go get the computer saying, Escarlenny, are you an immigrant? I was like, are you serious? I'm just trying to do my work and then you come and say this stuff. Like, just go sit down.
To Liz Herrera Reynoso, whose family's from the Dominican Republic, it seemed like people suddenly felt they could say anything, even racial slurs.
They said, like, I hope Trump builds the wall already, implying that I was Mexican just because I was Hispanic, like doing the stereotype that all Hispanics are Mexican and stuff like that, which I'm not.
All of these girls are from the city of York, and in the surrounding county, it's not uncommon to see Confederate flags on license plates, painted on trucks, or flying from someone's porch. During my visit at Tech, I didn't see any Confederate flags. But the girls insisted the symbol pops up in ways that might not be obvious.
They wear Confederate flags all the time. Yeah, they got them on their belt. They got shirts.
They have flags.
They have flags in their cars. They have hats.
York County's population is 86% white. And while Tech's student body is predominantly white, it's much more diverse by comparison. It's also the third largest of 23 high schools in York County, with 1,600 students. For those coming from the furthest corners of the county, the ride to school takes over an hour. Some students choose Tech so they can jump right into the workforce after graduating and earn a living wage. The school has a bunch of programs in construction, the auto industry, the medical field, just to name a few. And others want a better academic option than their local public high school.
These kids know more people that went to jail than to college. That shouldn't be.
That's Mike Smith. He grew up in York and works with kids like Delisha, Liz, and Escarlenny to deal with obstacles they face growing up here. As part of his job, Mike spends time counseling families on where to send their kids to high school.
All I want them to do is have options. When you got options, you can figure out what you want to do.
Over the past decade, Mike's worked with about 200 teenagers, and all of them have gone to college. But for him, success goes beyond grades. He also mentors the kids on how to deal with racial tension.
It's either one or the other. You're either going to push through it or they're going to become militant and be like, that's it. You know what I mean? Because of some of them, if you just say nigga, they're just going to do the stereotypical thing and try to fight you. You know what I mean? That's the militant side of it. Where some of them can take it like, you're trying to take me there. I'm not going to put myself in that situation. So it's just one of those things where with them, I mean, I do so much with them as far as it's not as much education, it is socialization. My biggest thing that I do is prepare them, because if I knew what they knew at that age, I wish I would have knew what I knew now. So what I do is, as a 49-year-old man, coming up being a minority, all my experiences, and I give it to them so that when they face it, some of the stuff that I give them, they won't even face yet until later. But they'll have the equipment to be able to make the right decisions.
Since the white power incident happened at Tech, Mike says parents are more hesitant about their kids going there.
And I know I was getting a lot of not wanting to go to the school now after it, not prior to it, since then. And I'm trying to sell the education piece. Regardless of that, even when you go to college, you're not going to be able to control how people
act. Yeah, it's really
not
a bad school.
That's Delisha you hear jumping into the conversation with Mike.
It's just a select few of the student body that if you don't know how to deal with it, it could break you. It could make you want to be like, oh, I'll never want to be around these type of people ever again in my life. But school overall is good, and I'm glad that I went to that school because I learned a lot of things, not only about myself, but about school and about how I could further my education.
And for Delisha, the day after the election was the tipping point.
There was a line from the office that went all the way around the media center of kids and parents who wanted to go home because they didn't feel safe.
Not everyone was affected the same way.
It was a normal day. School wasn't even started.
Joanne Prettyman has been a teacher at York Tech for over two decades. That morning, she saw two boys walking through the halls with a Trump sign and confiscated it. She had no idea a video had already been taken or what a bystander said just off camera.
White power!
It was being dealt with, it was dying. That happened, and that was not even in my realm of thought, that there was going to be a video. That video posting wasn't the thing that upset me the most, because that's kids. You give kids a camera and a phone, and that's going to happen. They take pictures of each other doing the strangest things. What upset me the most was news outlets all over got a hold of it, and that is what upset me more. I kind of felt like students were used to serve a different agenda for someone else.
One of her former students, Jennifer Smith, now a history teacher at Tech, put it this way.
Any school building, any place of employment, if they want to say they have no conflict between employees, between different groups of people, they're fooling themselves. Of course there are going to be disagreements between people. I mean, that's human nature to have a certain level of conflict.
Both teachers grew up in York County and say candid conversations about race are nothing new at Tech.
For years, honestly, in social studies, we've had really open conversations about...
Mm-hmm. Oh, all the time.
All the time. Real life scenarios. I mean, kids will admit, before I came to Tech, I was really afraid of kids that lived in the country. I thought they were all racist and they this, they that. And then the country kids, well, I was really afraid of kids in the city and going in the city. And then, you know, it's interesting, they become friends. They make this real friendship. Like, that's the real stuff. When you see kids really, truly learning about each other's experiences and where they come from and understanding, and that's been going on for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And honestly, talking about it and talking about how, you know, they are agents of change. Like, I will even talk about KKK activity where I grew up when I was a kid versus now. And how they are the ones that are going to make the final change. So those conversations have been happening for a really long time.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to sit back and say, oh, we had this lackadaisical, non-empathetic student body that wanted to do nothing. And then all of a sudden Donald Trump became president and two kids carried a sign and someone said a racial slur and now we do things. No, that's false.
That's true. The school already had programs such as Project Harmony, an initiative meant to encourage unity and inclusion. But after the White Power incident, administrators at York Tech felt compelled to take action, engaging with law enforcement, state education officials, and the Pennsylvania Human Relations Council. The PHRC says Tech wasn't alone, that about a dozen schools reached out for support in responding to bias incidents that happened close to the election. Tech also filled the diversity coordinator position that had been vacant for years.
Ching Ching, come on in. Have a seat, my dear.
Meet Carla Christopher, who's a poet, among many other things.
I preach to you because my conscience leaves me with no other choice. The time has come for America to hear the truth, even if only from a single voice.
Carla moved to the area 10 years ago to help raise her niece. She ended up staying after spending her life all over, Virginia, North Carolina, Michigan, upstate New York, college at Columbia in New York City, and Baltimore. When Carla found out Tech was looking for a diversity coordinator, she was balancing performance and poetry, including a stint as the City of York's Poet Laureate, and training to become a minister, and working as a community organizer and advocate. I checked in with her 6 weeks into the job.
The motivations of why people come to this school are so different. You know, everything about what's going on in one place where 14 school districts are coming together, where people of every income level are coming together, where people who have families that have history all over the place are coming together. Every single incident has a million moving parts. And so to make sure that everyone's heard, and then to make sure that the right solution gets put in place, it's just not the kind of thing that you can say, all right, well, I know why this happened and I know what we need to do to fix it. Everything goes deeper than that.
Carla says it seems like some teachers are more responsive than others, but figures it could be because they're busy.
Am I prepared that some of the teachers who I don't hear back from, that there might be more to their reticence? Sure, that's possible. It's even likely. Could be outright racism, it could be defensiveness, it could be thinking that I'm coming to train wreck their carefully orchestrated curriculum. You know, teachers invest a lot in developing their curriculum, and they don't always appreciate some new person coming in here, some idealized rookie that wants to come in and tear apart what they've been figuring out how to make work for 20 years. I get that. So I'm trying to let teachers know that that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to help, I'm here to support students, and I'm here to support teachers in the kind of changes that they're willing to carry out and make.
And Carla has made a lot of changes already. She's created guidelines to help teachers file complaints about harassment, worked with students to put on a diversity showcase, and she's introduced an evidence-based approach for how the school now plans to respond to a bias incident.
If a student is suspended for a bias crime or some kind of assaultive behavior, you know, verbal or physical, but where it's related to a name calling or something that has to do with gender, with discrimination, with race, they have a take-home series of student choice assignments that are all different approaches at teaching empathy. When they come back, they have to actually do a processing session with either myself or one of the school counselors to talk about the empathy aspect, putting themselves in other people's shoes, understanding the damage that they do. Same thing for students who resort to fighting or physical violence instead of using nonviolent communication skills.
On the afternoon I visited Carla, she was going through a stack of papers documenting York's history of racial tension. She says she has to go back decades at least to get a full understanding of the issues she's dealing with today.
It's not just, you know, the last few years, the last few incidents that are affecting what we're doing. It's what are people's views of the history of this place? What are people's views of the history of this region? You know, what defenses do they have up? What are their questions? What are their triggers? What are they looking for? You know, that affects how people respond. It affects how open they are. It affects how much community buy-in we can get when we're doing these initiatives. So if there's things that happened before, I need to know. You know, stuff that worked. What didn't work? Why didn't it work? If it worked at first, but then it fell apart, why did it fall apart? Was it that people got complacent because it was working? Is it that certain things were just too hard? Is it that we were talking to the wrong people? That we didn't involve the right people in the solutions? That's everything about what I'm trying to do now, is figure out what the missing pieces are.
To help us understand York's complex history around race relations, you can't overlook what happened in the 1960s. York College professor Peter Levy has studied the area's civil rights history.
York is interesting because it had a fairly severe race revolt, which was virtually unknown when even the city ignored it. Insofar as, I mean, you literally had black-on-white fire shooting and back and forth. I mean, not only are two people killed, there's over 20 people who were shot at some point. It's almost remarkable that no more people were killed.
There were hundreds of race riots in the U.S. in the 60s, most of them in small or mid-sized cities like York. But what came before the riots is significant, too. There was tension building for years. The police started using canines in 1962, and most of the patrols were in predominantly black neighborhoods. Black residents demanded a police review board and protested over major issues like substandard housing and limited job opportunities. They had the support of city council and a local newspaper, but the mayor at the time wouldn't meet with the community. Ultimately, their concerns were ignored for all practical purposes. Jeff Kirkland, who's 67 years old, came of age during that time. He still lives in the city, in a neighborhood that used to be all white. Emily visited him at home one afternoon, and he told her stories about the 1960s. Just a warning, there will be some strong language and graphic descriptions here.
When I got to Jeff's house, it had been raining steadily for hours. He was working on a photo restoration project in his office, surrounded by artwork and photos on the walls. There was jazz on, but he turned it off before we got started. Jeff began in a way that I didn't expect.
I was reflecting back on a friend of mine. He just passed today, a guy. I used to work with him. I worked at the Children's Home of York back in 1966, 67. We're orphans and people that didn't have places, and he stayed there. And one time, he used to live out in the Parkway Projects. His name was Steve Smallwood. He was about 13 years old, and he had went home for a weekend visit. And on his way back, he was walking back, and he got down by the Seatown food market, and some white guys pulled up in the car and pulled a gun on him. Said, "Get in the car, nigger." Took him out in the country, beat him up real bad, flushed his head in the toilet, took a razor and scalped him and tied him up and put him in a bag, a trash bag, and threw him out on the highway. And some man was riding past and saw the bag moving and thought it might have been a dog or something in it. And when he opened it up, it was him, and they rushed him to the hospital. Luckily, he did, and he saved his life. It was a big story back then, because it was in sort of like an escalation. Before, there were fights, you know? White guys, we might be fighting all like that. It wasn't a whole lot of that. I mean, we'd go to school. You know, I was friends with a lot of white guys, and we had friends and different things. But you always had fights
Some of them, you know, may have racial overtones, but that type of thing didn't invade our community often.
After what happened to Steve Smallwood, Jeff and some of the others he worked with at the children's home took extra measures to protect themselves.
We had weapons. We had guns. We had them under our beds and all down there at night after that.
Pistols or rifles? Or
shotguns and rifles. We never knew what was going to be happening.
At this point, Jeff walked me over to this framed collage of newspaper clippings he's collected over the years about York's Black experience, student walkouts, Klan rallies, and violence.
Story there, my friend's father, Carl Williams, was picked up by the police. Took him, he was drunk, he was alcoholic, he was drunk. Mm-hmm. They took him down to Smalls Field, where our athletic field is, and tried to make a clown out of him, dance, nigga, you know, and making him dance, stuff, shooting, and beating him, hitting him with a club, and ended up killing him. Then they lied and said they didn't pick him up, but there was so many witnesses saw when they put him in the car over at the bar, and then they found a policeman's club right by his body and all like that. So they were prosecuted, but then they were let off. They were suspended and all like that, but it's just so many things, you know. This is where my brother Eric was shot up. So we were coming back from a party, and this guy, Chester Roach, he's going down through the alley, and he said, "Why don't you niggers stop that noise?" And one of the guys said, "Well, why don't you stop us?" And he came out with his guns, and he started firing and shooting and shot 11 people.
Nobody died. And Jeff says everyone was even able to run away and take cover as the shooter, Chester Roach, came out onto the street.
This guy here, William Mutt Orr, snuck up in back of him and knocked the gun out of his hand. And everybody went on him, almost killed him. By that time, the police had come and all. They came with the armor car to get him out of there.
But later, people came back to retaliate, throwing firebombs at the market below Roach's apartment.
Mutt Orr, subsequently, about 3 months later, somebody drove by his house right up the street from there, and he was up eating breakfast, getting ready to go to work, and fired in the window and shot him and killed him.
It turns out that Orr was supposed to testify against Roach, who ultimately was acquitted for lack of evidence. By the end of the 1960s, tensions had flared so much in the city that riots eventually broke out there in July of 1969. Here's what Jeff remembers.
There was just random shootings. A couple people one night got shot, and then the next night more people got shot. Things just escalated. And I worked for like 2 days or work, you know, we did different schedules working, and I came back home. And we had to stay in the house mainly. I remember peeping out the window. That was after the National Guard got there and all, and they were saying, you know, get out of the windows. Shut those windows up. Aiming the weapons and all, like, you know.
During the riots, 20 people were injured. A white rookie police officer named Henry Shad was shot and died 2 weeks later. A white power rally was held in a park, and a police officer named Charlie Robertson, who later became mayor of York, shouted white power during the rally. A day later, a group of white men fatally shot Lily Bell Allen, a black woman from South Carolina who was visiting family in York. The atmosphere in the city was tense, as Jeff recalls.
I didn't carry my weapon with me and all like that, you know, around those times. Like friends of mine, I know guys that did, you know, all the time. I was sort of like a spectator most of the time, just out there with the anxiety, you know, running when the cops come, might throw a couple things when the cops come and then run. You know, it was pretty scary. We thought the police was shooting just to shoot. I remember seeing the police lined up along the roof, and everyone swears they were doing some of the shooting and all, like, you know, it was just so much going on, the rumors.
Jeff says that today, racial tension isn't blatant as it was years ago, but he says it's still there, and he spends time mentoring young people in York about how to move forward.
I don't know why York continues to be like that, because sometimes I get discouraged and get frustrated with what's going on, like it doesn't look like much progress, or like maybe we should just give up. Give up, just accept what is. But we need to make some effort, I think, for our kids' sake and all that type of thing, you know, to try and blend this. This is not nothing new. This is a continuing battle, you know, for uplifting our community and for excellence in our community. It gives me, you know, hope and impetus and motivation to keep working and keep doing something, you know.
People were dying for making the change, so my generation got something to gain. No need for the fighting, what that's gonna get you, but death and the suffering, killing the pain. Difference can color, but homie, we brothers. We can
argue. That's Naku, who we heard from at the beginning of the show. His offstage name is Tyrell Bryant. He's 19 years old, and Emily met Naku in the studio to talk with him about what inspired his song, Brothers.
Naku arrived first for our interview at a professional studio in downtown York. At that point, it had been over a month since his song Brothers had dropped, and it already had millions of views on YouTube and listens on iTunes and Spotify. But the seed for the song was planted well before that. He told me that on a winter afternoon, about a year ago, he was out shoveling snow, trying to make money, when a cop drove by and yelled a racial slur at him.
I was with two other people, and I was riding, walking in the middle of the street. There was a car coming. It was a cop car speeding. Like, he was actually driving fast, and I see he wasn't stopping, so I moved out the way. As soon as I moved out the way, he said what he said. I kind of had that in my head already. Not as in, like, every cop is like that and stuff like that, or every person is like that, but it's going to happen eventually because this is life. Like, this is the world that we live in, and history is history, you feel me? And sometimes, history won't go away. History will always be there. And I just feel as though that in my mind, I wouldn't say I was prepared for it, but I already knew how the world goes. So when it did happen, it didn't really surprise me. What if I would have retaliated back towards that cop? What situation would I have been in if that would have ever happened? You don't have to have violence to solve everything. Like, you could solve everything with speech. You can't solve everything with speech, but you could give a try. A voice is real powerful, especially if you could get people to listen.
Naku says between the incident with the cop, the election, and related bias incidents he saw in the national news and even in his own backyard, he was inspired to produce the song we've been hearing. He wrote it with another hip-hop artist named Young Verse, a white ex-Marine living in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Naku says the two collaborated remotely and never met in person.
A lot of people don't like to talk about racism now. I don't know why, but, like, there's no need for racism no more. It's a new generation. Like, it's going to die down eventually. I believe that.
Not long after Naku released his song, he heard from the local mayor in the neighboring borough of West York.
He wanted to meet up with me. He saw the song that went viral, and he was, like, really thankful. He thanked me for doing that because he said that we need more of that as youth and then in our community, that we need more people to spread the word. He's trying to do the same thing. He's trying to make a change. This is a new generation.
Here is a young man who understands what a divisive, powerful situation he's talking about, and he found a way to get through to people.
That's Sean Malk, the mayor of West York, a 4,000-person borough bordering York City. He found out about Naku the same way I did, through a York Daily Register story about the song going viral. Malk says after reading the article and checking out the song, he sent Naku a message on social media. Eventually, Naku met with Malk at his office in Borough Hall.
His age. That's awesome. See, younger people have already figured this out. It's people that are older than them that seem to be stuck in this generational void of, like, we don't want to talk about it.
Malk became the mayor of West York in a somewhat unorthodox fashion. His predecessor, Charles Wasco, who generally goes by Chuck, was pressured to resign after posting offensive photos of President Barack Obama and his family on Facebook. Malk was borough council president at the time.
York Dispatch called and said, hey, you know, we have a breaking story, and can you take a look at something? And I was brought to my attention the pictures. First, I was taken back to the point where it made me sick. I'm thinking, what? You know, this is a guy I have to work with. But I never would have thought I'd see what I saw on his Facebook page.
As the story was covered internationally, Wasco remained unapologetic and resisted demands for his resignation coming from all levels, including one from the governor.
We very early on said, look, you need to apologize. You need to make this right. Of course, he did not. Especially when he did the on-camera saying, yeah, I said that, I posted that, I feel that way, and I don't really care what you think. kind of get out of my face mentality because I'm not apologizing. I think that doubling down and tripling down on his hatred made it difficult for him even more so.
Wasco, a retired county jail officer who became mayor by winning an unopposed election, has been inconsistently selective about which reporters he talks to post-scandal. He hasn't responded to my messages or voicemails and ignored me when I knocked on his door when he was at home and in plain view, sitting at his computer next to an open window. Eventually, he resigned. Borough Council appointed Malk to finish out Wasco's term, and Malk since won the Democratic nomination for a full 4 years.
My predecessor, I don't think he realizes the damage he did to our community and the perception it gave. I can tell you firsthand how bad it was, but I think to go further than that, there are families still here suffering from systematic racism and the hurt that it causes. There are still families afraid to talk about their experience because they're afraid of the retribution it brings. That's not okay. We need to stay focused on the topic until no one has to feel afraid anymore, and certainly that no one has to feel like they have to move.
The Wasco incident seems like it's pushed community leaders to confront racial tension in West York. The police have shifted their focus to neighborhood foot patrols and developing relationships with residents. Borough officials are also updating non-discrimination ordinances and even considering decriminalizing marijuana. And the City of York's Human Relations Council is now based in West York. Malk says the Human Relations Council now being in West York could be an opportunity for residents to file a complaint and use other council services. He also says what he views as progress has made him and his family a target.
I've been a target myself for being someone who's advocating for change. I've been called some pretty interesting names. My children had been targeted because they have a little darker tone to their skin. The N-word has been used in reference to them.
And not too long ago, at a borough council meeting, Malk retold a story from a Black constituent whose child was called a racial slur by another adult. Malk said the whole word out loud, and he was criticized for it, but the controversy was relatively brief.
I regret that anybody had any visceral pain from what I was putting forward from someone else. But I don't regret the fact that I'm shining a light on the very ugly, dark problem we have. What's the main focus is the fact that there are families that literally deal with this every day. They're so afraid to talk about it, or they've been told not to talk about it because it's taboo. I don't think that's okay. I think we need to find a way for them to share their story unvarnished in a way that we understand the pain that they're going through. And I realize that that's going to evoke a lot of emotion across the spectrum. But until we call it for what it is, until we point out how ugly and hurtful it is, I don't believe we're going to change it.
Be sure to check out part two of our series. We'll try to understand what's behind racial tension in York and explore how the area is unique in some ways, but also reflective of other places.
The whys for York County, I think, are the same for throw a dart at the map in the U.S., and I think the answers would be pretty much the same.
People come to me and confide in me, that's causing racial tension. They won't speak out about it because of the stigma. If you're white and you speak out on behalf of your people, you get labeled these term buzzwords like racist and white supremacist.
And don't miss our photos of the people and places you heard on the show. You can find the photos online at keystonecrossroads.org/grapple. Grapple is produced by Keystone Crossroads in association with Cuvenda Media. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporter, Emily Previty, WHYY's Diana Martinez for engineering our show, and Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Cuvenda Media, and I'm Naomi Steroban, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.